That was McCoy Tyner and Bobby Hutcherson in their album Manhattan Moons, and the track was Traveling Blues. That was, again, McCoy Tyner, who unfortunately just passed away a few days ago, March 6th. He was born December 11th, 1938, in Philadelphia. Just a little bit about Alfred Tyner. He was an American jazz pianist known for his work with the John Coltrane Quartet, and he had a long solo career. He was an NEA Jazz Master and a 5-time Grammy winner. Unfortunately, he passed away on March 6th, but he had a very successful career. This is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and of course, you can stream us online at WFT. My name is Ben Theobald. This is where we are at. During this hour, I usually talk about what's going on in politics, whether it be national, state, or local, sometimes even world. But I hope you're staying warm and staying inside, considering the weather. It's still raining, and it's going to be probably raining until for the rest of the night, for the rest of the day. It will eventually stop late, in fact, probably, you know, once you go to bed tonight at a reasonable hour, you and wake up tomorrow morning. Also, I hope you know that it's daylight savings time, so we lost an hour this past weekend. And let's see. I have an interview. I will be. Excuse me. Let me get my train of thought as I get here. I interviewed a candidate for the who was running for Champaign County Clerk. His name is Robert Burkhalter. He was a candidate for Champaign. Or the circuit clerk, Champaign circuit clerk, and you will be hearing my interview with him in just a little bit. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. I do have some guidelines or PSA, public service announcements, I want to kind of get through. If you've been paying attention to the news, you probably have heard about the coronavirus or COVID-19. We do have, so please be careful, be safe, wash your hands. This is from the CDC's website, which if you want to go for information about how to protect yourself and be safe from, coronavirus, it's CDC, you can go to cdc.gov. This is the statement they have on there. There's currently no vaccine to prevent coronavirus disease. The best way to prevent illness is to avoid being exposed to this virus. However, as a reminder, CDC always recommends everyday preventive actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases, including avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick, although that's kind of hard to do if you can't afford to miss any work, if you have to use your sick days or vacation days. That's just reality there. But if you have to, if you can afford to stay home, if you are not feeling well, then you probably should do that. Cover your cough or sneezes. Sorry, I'm continuing with the CDC's information. Cover your cough or sneezes with a tissue, then throw that tissue in the trash. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects and surfaces using a regular household cleaning spray or wipe. Follow CDC's recommendations for if you can use a face mask. CDC does not recommend that people who are well wear a face mask to protect themselves from respiratory diseases, including the coronavirus. Face masks should be used by people who show symptoms of COVID to help prevent the spread of disease to others. And again, there's more website that's on the CDC's website that you can go to, cdc.gov. The Champaign's Men's Emergency Winter Shelter is also available now until the month, until April 15th, between the hours of 8 p.m. and 7 p.m. 8 p.m. and 7 a.m. The shelter is located at 70 East Washington Street in Champaign. There is some food available, such as light snacks, but no meals are served. Showers and laundry are also not available. For more information, you can contact Aletha Keith. The phone number is 217-819-5469. And the after business hours and the after business hours number is 217-8. Sorry, I'm not the PSA is the paper is a little far from me. 217-888-0329. Again, the number is 217-888-0329. In the Champaign Women's Emergency Shelter, Austin's Place is also available now through April 15th between the hours of 7:30 p.m. and 7 a.m. Screening for the shelter will occur at Courage Connection, which is located at the address of 504 East Church Street in Champaign, from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. each evening. Transportation to the shelter at First United Methodist Church is provided by volunteers. Light snacks are available, but again, no meals are served. Showers and laundry are not available. Guests will be provided with bus tokens in the morning. For more information, you can contact Ruth Moore. The phone number is 217-356-9078. Again, the number is 217-356-9078. And the after business hours is 217-888-0329. Again, 217-888-0329, St. Andrew's Church, which is located at 909 South Wright Street in Urbana, will open its doors at 5:45 p.m. Communities meals on Wednesdays, followed by fellowships, Bible study and discussions. So you can, showers are available for women on Tuesdays and Fridays from 10:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. during the Austin's Place operating sessions. Sorry, that took me a little while to get through. It's kind of hard to see from here. Let's see. Are there any other PSAs? Let's see. Today is the 9th. There will be a performance by Ryan Groff of Elsinore and Perennial Sound Studio on March 11th. So that will be Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. at the third floor lecture hall of Levis Faculty Center, which is located at 919 West Illinois Street in Urbana. That's the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. So again, March 11th, Ryan Groff. Time is Ryan Groff of Elsinore and Perennial Sound Studio. March 11th, March 11th, 7:30 p.m., third floor, lecture hall, Levis Faculty Center. I'm just going to go ahead and play my... I did an interview with Robert Burkhalter for Circuit Clerk. And he is one of many candidates that if you will be voting in the upcoming Illinois primary, which will be a week from tomorrow. That is March 17th. I know that it will be spring break for many college students. So please, if you are able to vote and you are interested in voting and you won't be here because you're a student and it's spring break and you will be going, maybe you should consider getting that done. I believe early voting is open. You can go to the Champaign County Clerk's website. Just Google Champaign County Clerk, all information about where you can vote. And I believe if you want to register to vote, that is also on there. But so without further ado, this is my interview with Robert Burkhalter, who is running for Champaign County Clerk. I have the interview set up and it should hopefully play. So here it is.
Hi, I'm Robert Burkhalter. I'm running for Champaign County Circuit Clerk, running for the Democratic nomination here in the 2020 election cycle.
Where do you currently live?
I currently live in Champaign. I live over by Franklin Middle School, so Champaign, Harvard, and Harris.
How long have you lived here in Champaign?
In Champaign, I moved here in 1993, Champaign or Urbana. I came here to go to school.
So you're running Champaign County Circuit Clerk. What made you want to run for this position?
So I've worked for the circuit clerk and the circuit court for 13 years. I started in the circuit clerk's office. Originally, I worked there for about 5 years, and then I moved upstairs to work in the circuit courts. I've been there for the last 8 years. The time that I've worked there and the time that I've moved upstairs and worked in the courts, we've seen some decline in the quality of the work coming out of that office. I'm educated in that realm. I'm experienced in that realm, and I think I can help.
And currently, I guess if you want to talk a little bit about your background and your experience.
I came here to go to school. When I got out of school, I did a lot of service jobs. I did a lot of retail. I worked at the liquor store. I worked at the Courier in Urbana. I had a pretty good gig at Strawberry Fields, running their food service for about 6 or 7 years. And then they decided to close their food service, end of business. So I was amicably out of work. And a guy who had worked for me that I had been friends with in college and ended up working for me at Strawberry Fields had gotten a job at the courthouse. And he said, "We're hiring." And so I went in there and filled out an application. And this was long enough ago that I still filled out an application. Got interviewed, and weirdly enough, his last day was on a Friday, and I started the next Monday. So I've been there ever since. That was 2006. And then, like I said, I worked for the circuit clerk for about 5 years, got promoted to the circuit court, and I've been working for various circuit judges ever since.
Currently work for Judge Ford.
That's right.
What has that experience been like?
Judge Ford has been on the bench for a very long time, so he's got a wealth of experience. It's actually been very rewarding. So one of the things that assignment entails is major law litigation, which is like people suing for lots of money. A lot of it is medical stuff, medical malpractice, or suing your insurance company, things like that. Right, so there's a lot of pain and suffering, a lot of people struggling to get reimbursed, and they don't, so they take it to court. And, you know, so you see that, the inside of that side of things a lot, and it makes you realize what's going on in the world. But those people also tend to be represented by pretty good lawyers, so you see pretty good practitioners of law. I mean, I've certainly sat in some interesting, if not captivating, you know, trial isn't like it is on TV. It's not usually that thrilling, but I've sat through a lot of interesting trials in there. And then the other half that I've really, really found rewarding, Judge Ford has administered Champaign County Drug Court for the last 20 years. And that is, you know, a problem-solving court that he helped incept here in Champaign County, and he's been running it ever since, and he's very involved with problem-solving courts in the state of Illinois. He recently, you know, after 20 years, his drug court just got certified by the Illinois Supreme Court. Yeah, he's very proud of that, and that's really something, like, court isn't always, you don't always see reward. There you do. You get to see people have successes and you know, maybe be in really dire straits when they come into drug court and learn some tools and learn some skills and learn some mechanisms to kind of put themselves back on the right track. And we've seen just a ton of successes. Of course, there's still failures and there's heartbreak. And there's, even in the short time that I've been with him for a year and a half, and I've seen 3 or 4 graduating classes. We do it twice a year. We've seen people come back and laud their success stories. And we've got people who are graduates who hire people who are in drug court give them opportunities to work and things like that. So you see it kind of be a community that builds on itself. We've seen people in the midst of the work overdose. So it can be the whole range of emotions.
How would you describe what the Champaign County Circuit Clerk does to someone who may not be familiar with?
The short answer is that it is the keeper of the court records. Everything that happens in court needs to be documented.
Yeah, like traffic tickets.
Everything. So traffic tickets, criminal stuff, misdemeanors and felonies, divorces, adoptions, family laws, divorces, and then usually like child custody is where that will keep going. Probate, which is wills and estates, small claims court. So anytime, you know, you're suing your neighbor for $100 over who ruined the fence, or, you know, a lot of times what goes on in that courtroom is evictions. So people getting forcibly removed by their landlord and things like that. So, I mean, literally everything that you can bring a court action for has to have a record, and that's what the circuit clerk does, is keep those records. So as a court clerk, I'm making the record. The circuit clerk is more the repository of all those records and the public access to all of those records.
How important would you say is, like, the relationship between the circuit clerk and the judge? Is there, like, a lot of...
I think the better that relationship, the better work environment that you have. I think if you're on the same page, I think if the circuit clerk employees understand what court needs and court understands what the circuit clerk is going through, then obviously you're going to have a better working relationship and you're going to produce a better work product. I think there are 11 or 12 court clerks. I think there's 12 because we have 11 judges and we have one extra. And I think 9 or 10 of us came from the circuit clerk's office. So it's certainly interrelated. You know, that's sort of a starting place. And then you move up into the courtroom and you kind of understand the other side of everything you've been doing. And I think even just from my own experience, sometimes in the circuit clerk's office, you don't get the explanation of what it is that you're doing. And I think that that's something that I can bring to the table, is I've now been to the other side. I know what this document does in court, and so I can help you understand it. So you're not just pushing a piece of paper into a file. It has a consequence. It has a remedy. It has a reason why it exists. A lot of what happens in court is procedural and perfunctory, and so paperwork being in the right place can cause people to get the thing done or not get the thing done in a timely fashion.
In terms of providing assistance to people who maybe are disabled, and is that very how circuit clerk works?
Yeah, first of all, that's a forefront of like where you want to address. Are we compliant with ADA?
Disability
acts and stuff. Obviously, you know, we want to bring that in. And the whole key is the circuit clerk is where you're going to start and end your transaction in court as a member of the public. I mean, as a member of the bar and the judiciary as well. But they obviously have a little bit better understanding of how things work. The average person walks in. The first person they're going to start asking questions to is the circuit clerk. So if they're having accessibility issues, you need to be able to address that. If they're having language issues, you need to be able to address that. Yeah. There is a drawback, which is that nobody that works in the circuit clerk's office, at least the employees, are not lawyers. So then we're not allowed to give legal advice. Mm-hmm. So there's a fine line between I can help you find the form, but I can't fill it out for you. You know, so because that would be giving you legal advice, and then you can go in and say, well, the guy told me to do this. Well, I mean, you shouldn't listen to that guy because he's not a lawyer. So, and you'll even see that in court. People will ask the judge, what do I do? And the judge can't give you legal advice because that's not his role. Now, the judge is a lawyer, usually. I don't think they'll let anybody that's not a lawyer be a judge anymore. But their role is to be neutral and to be the decider, so they can't be giving any one side an advantage by giving advice.
Currently, now person that holds the position is
Katie Blakeman.
Is a Republican.
She is.
Yeah. What do you feel like you could do better in this position?
I just feel like, you know, and I don't think it has necessarily anything to do with her politics, particularly. I think it's just she didn't work there before she was elected. She didn't work in the legal field before she was elected. I think she's a bright enough woman and capable enough and certainly well-intentioned. But I think it gets away from you when you don't do it every day. And, you know, I think what I can bring is the experience and the understanding of, like I said, what's happening in court and how it happens and what the timetable is and why dates are important and why it's important to get notice out. You know, there's so many little things that happen in a court case that if they don't happen, you have to stop, go back and do them, and then move forward, because if you skip it, it opens the door for the whole thing to be thrown out.
And you currently, as we stated, currently work with Jeff Ford. who were the other judges?
Certainly, I can remember. The first judge I was, the first assignment I got was as the swing clerk, which is the person who rotates for everybody. So I actually learned a lot of courtrooms doing that. The first judge I was assigned to, his name was Judge Kloss. The next judge I was assigned to, his name was Judge Olmsted, and then Judge Ford. So those three judges are the ones that I've worked with for most of my time up there. I have clerked for every judge on the bench that currently sits on the bench. So I've been in every courtroom. I've done every docket call. But obviously, like today, I worked with Judge Dill in arraignment court, and it was a very long day. So, you know, but I did. So a lot of those, two of those judges, the assignment didn't change, just the judge in charge of them did. So we did juvenile abuse and neglect, which is a tough call. And, you know, DCFS and kids, and it's tough. And then arraignment court or misdemeanor court. So misdemeanor, you know, being lesser crimes, whatnot. And then arraignment court is if you get arrested, that's where the whole criminal court process starts is you go in, you stand in front of the judge, you have the charges read to you, you get bond assigned, which, you know, bond is a big topic in Champaign County these days and in Illinois courts these days. So that's where that starts. So I did a lot of that for a lot of years.
And now, as circuit clerk, do they have any responsibility in terms of expungement?
Yes.
Services?
So that's where you would file it. The circuit clerk is where you would file any case. So if you're walking in the door and you need to file something, that's where you're going to go. So any court action starts in the circuit clerk's office. Now, the only people can bring criminal court action is the state's attorney. So they're the same deal. They file it in the clerk's office, but obviously they're in the building and they a little different than walking up to the counter, and there's different methods for them to open files every day. But back to expungements, absolutely. One of the things that we want people to know is that is a service that is always available in the circuit clerk's office. All you have to do is file your petition and pay your fee or apply for a fee waiver, which would get sent up to get approved by a judge. But in my experience, generally, a lot of times people that are looking to get their records expunged are doing so that they can expand their employment opportunities. Maybe they're unemployed or underemployed. I'm trying to clean up some past records. So the fee waivers are income driven, and I believe that the dictum from the Supreme Court is that isn't the reason to preclude someone from filing. We don't want it to be financial. So judges take a pretty broad view of fee waivers unless you really have more than enough means. On your fee waiver, you're going to get approved, and then that starts the process. So the individual citizen trying to do that would start right there at the circuit clerk's office.
Is there anything that, any moments that you would like people to know about working with judges like Jeff Ford?
Well, working with judges are particular people, and they have a particular view of how they like things done. You know, you're talking about somebody who within the four corners of their courtroom is ruling on law. So that's some serious, that's some heady stuff. So there are people that take their jobs very seriously. There are people that want the record in front of them to be correct. And when someone comes in and says, well, I filed that, and they don't have it, certainly that's going to be like, well, that doesn't help me make the decisions I need to make. So when they don't have that information, it's frustrating for everyone. You build a relationship. It's, I suppose, a lot like maybe any professional and their administrative assistant or anything like that, but you learn to rely on each other, you learn to anticipate each other's needs, you learn to be able to guess what they're going to want and what they're going to want to do. An odd thing about judges is they really can't talk to people because it's usually two parties in a case, and they can't talk to one without talking to the other. So a lot of times that falls to me. So I answer the phone from one side, and then I got to reach out to the other side. And so that I'm sort of a go-between in that regard. Judge, what do you want to do about this? And then I got to take it to the parties and then bring it back to him.
What would I say? You're kind of like the messenger?
A little bit. I mean, you know, in the sense that I'm delivering the message, in the sense that the message comes from me, absolutely not. You know, the judges, I don't have the authority or the ability or the expertise to make any sort of decisions in a legal capacity, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, and sometimes it's as simple as I'll lean back in my chair and say, Judge, what do you want to do about this? I'll call into his office. But sometimes you sit down and you have to have a conversation, and I want you to do this and this, and then you need to call all the parties. And sometimes it is giving direction to the circuit clerk. A lot of times the circuit clerk is tasked with sort of the perfunctory duties of send notice to all the parties. So sometimes you have to physically get notice out, and there are legal requirements for it needs to either be sent by mail or by email with a record of that being sent so that you can say people received this and they knew that their hearing was 21 days from now.
Was there a moment or something, okay, you know what, I'm going to run for civil service kind of, was there a moment or just
I think,
something that hit
No, you? I think it had been building for a while. We've been frustrated. We've seen, like I said, we've just seen a bit of a decline. And then I think the thing that sort of hit me between the eyes, I mean, obviously the success of Democrats in the 2018 cycle is certainly uplifting for everyone. So I thought maybe that might even out. I'm running against, if I make it through the primary, I'm running against a relatively popular incumbent office holder that's been there for two terms already. So, you know, that is an advantage when you're running in politics, as I'm sure you know, name recognition means a lot. So I thought maybe, you know, maybe the change in tenor here in Champaign-Urbana around politics might even out that advantage. But what really got me to want to get involved was watching people leave. I've seen over half of the employees in the last calendar year leave in an office of 40 people, so almost 20. That's a lot. Anytime you have a 50% turnover, you're dealing with an issue that's not being addressed. And I don't think it's not the highest paying job in the world, but it's not the lowest. And it has benefits, and it has a pension, and it's a union job. You know, it's got union protections. And so then you're still seeing people walk away from that. And I'm like, well, what's going on? I mean, I started there and I was able to build my life and build, have enough money to buy a home and to start participating in this community. And I'm not a rich man. I mean, you know, not on a exorbitant salary, but enough to start getting into those things.
What can you guys tell about your personal life? Are you family?
Yeah, I'm married. I have a daughter. She's 2.5. She's the most important thing in my life. You know, I'm in my 40s, so I didn't get married until 2016. So, and
so 44 years
coming up on it. Yeah, so be May. It'll be 4 years. So I think, honey, if you're listening, I hope that's right. And then our daughter was born in 2017. You know, she'll be 3 here coming up in July. That's before that, like I was living the single life and living the retail life and living the service life and met a lot of people and done a lot of things here in this town, which is a cool place to live. You know, I came from small town nowhere. A little town called Sterling in Northwest Illinois. I think a lot of times when kids come down here for school from Chicago, they're like, this is a cornfield. If you actually grew up on a cornfield, like I did, this is a cool place. You know, there's a ton of things to do here. There's a ton of art. There's a ton of diversity. There's a ton of opportunities. So that's why I was drawn to stay here. And then, you know, did okay working around, getting advancement, being successful in a couple of different venues. And then this job actually opened up the opportunity to, like I said, to really lay down some roots. And my wife and I are both happy here. So
how are you balancing family and job and professional and running for office, because that obviously you have to take some time out.
It's been a grind and it's been a learning curve, but I think that's maybe one of the things that keeps the average person from running. And I don't think it's that you have to have specific qualifications to run. I mean, I think you should be qualified for the position you want to run for, but there's nothing to stop anybody from being a politician starting tomorrow, except that you got to have the time and the will and the determination to do it. And I'm not entirely sure that I knew what I was getting into, but it's been rewarding. It's been great. It's been tiring, you know? And I think about some of the people that have been running back-to-back election cycles, and they must just be sadly exhausted. And it does take away time. But thankfully, I think my daughter's at the right age where she understands that I'm gone, but she isn't distressed by it. She thinks it's fun. She's like, oh, Dad's going to go Burke for clerk, you know, so, and they can come out and see me at things. You know, when we did the farmer's market and stuff, obviously my wife could bring my daughter out to that and still enjoy the farmer's market, and then they could see Dad and do things. It balances is the right word, but I'm certainly looking forward to primary is in 10 days.
March
17th.
Yeah, be about a week when this airs, a week from tomorrow.
Right.
My show is on Monday.
Monday night, so yeah.
A week from
Tuesday, March 17th. Yeah, coming right up. And so I think that win or lose, there will be a touch of downtime there. And I'm looking forward to maybe spending a little extra time with my family.
Where can people find more about, they want to know more?
Sure. My website is burkforclerk.com, burkforclerk.com. And the same thing on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. If you do at Burke for Clerk, that'll get you there on all three of those platforms. So yeah, check it out. You know, I send me an email, contact@burkeforclerk.com. I'm happy to engage with anybody. I don't really have a staff. It's me. It might be my wife saying, hey, you've got an email. But so if you contact me, you'll probably get a response from me.
Is there anything else you want to let people know about you or your background? experience?
I think I'm a regular person that was drawn into doing this because I saw a job that I knew how to do that needed attention, in my opinion. Not doing this to be an elected official. That's just the byproduct of maybe being in a position to help fix the situation. And I think the situation, I don't know that it's dire, but it certainly needs attention. And like I said, I want people to know that they can work there and be successful, and the people that work there need to be supported and trained. And so we can get there. Court is a really fun place to work. It's a really exciting place to work, but it's full of really dull components sometimes.
But obviously important.
And it's super important, you know? And I think the other thing is that we want to see that office, if the people that work there are more supported and more comfortable knowing their job, the interactions that you have are with people who are probably having some variant of a bad day. Whether it's a traffic ticket or a divorce, there's not a whole lot of gloriously happy moments that happen in a courthouse, unfortunately. So, and to them, it's probably one of the most important things happening in their life right now. To have a staff that can help you navigate that and help you move through that, the machinations, which can be daunting, successfully, I think that's an important community service.
Thank you very much,
Bob Burkhalter.
Bob Burkhalter.
Yep, that's me, and thank you for having me, and I appreciate the time.
R-O-J-E-C-T, so it's F.
Sorry about that. Yep, that was Bob Burkhalter again. Thank you for him to Champaign County Clerk. Again, if you are able to vote, the registration, you can check your registration. Go to champaigncountyclerk.com if you are interested. Again, there are only 8 days until the election. Until the Illinois primary, which is March 17th. I believe Michigan and Missouri's primaries are tomorrow, as are Idaho, North Dakota. In the words of former President Barack Obama, if you don't vote in the primary and come November you don't like the candidates, well, you can't complain. You didn't vote for that. We have a caller coming in. Let me get him on the air. Let's see. 5, 4, 3, 8, 3. Okay. Caller, can you introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, hello. My name is Alan Axelrod. I am a Bernie Sanders delegate candidate, and also I am part of Stephanie Smith's congressional campaign in Illinois 13th District.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling. What do you want to, and I know you've obviously called in before, and of course you've been on this show before. What do you want to talk about? What did you want to talk about? Since we only have about a week until the Illinois primary, and of course, the other primaries that have been going on, what did you want to talk about, Alan?
Well, I mean, first off, I think that it would be a good idea to come back on given what happened after I left the show last time. So for those who don't remember, about 2 weeks ago, a little bit after Ben's show, I don't know the exact time still, there was a nonviolent protest that upset a lot of people. Those same people are not upset about the death threats that Stephanie has received as a result of the right-wing media of that event. So there is a bit of a contradiction there that I think people should acknowledge. And indeed, a few people have. So why hasn't everybody else? It is important to emphasize that one person was interfered with via a nonviolent action, which is protected by First Amendment rights. What right does someone have to threaten someone else's life? And why are people more okay with that? So that is one thing that I would like to invite people to think about when it comes to the fact that not only did she receive death threats, she was accused of having organized the nonviolent protest, deplatformed, uninvited from things, and then reinvited after new events were scheduled. So I think that there has to be some soul searching for the people who are asking for folks to vote blue no matter who, when they so thoroughly abuse, gaslight, and ignore threats against people's lives who are entering into the political system. We had members of Central Illinois DSA have their car windows busted in just today, and they believe that it is because of the Planned Parenthood protesters' 40 days, where they are doing basically intimidation actions outside of a Planned Parenthood in Decatur so as to try and shut it down, or at least fundraise for their cause. Members of Central Illinois DSA have been counter-protesting that, with only one progressive joining them. Everybody else sitting on their hands, waiting for it to go away. And, you know, these people were then attacked. Why are people okay with that? I would suggest that people who are not okay with that be vocal about it, because silence is complicity here. That said, it's also important to note the broader political situation that people are in. Very many people at this point are thinking that maybe the Sanders campaign will not win the primary and are worried about what that means for the general election. I share those concerns, do not have any answers, and am hoping as a delegate candidate to at least have some input on whatever corrections are possible, because there shouldn't be the ability to change polling locations so shortly before a primary, but there is, and that's a systemic issue. If the Democratic Party is not an appropriate venue for solving that, then it needs to be a governmental one. There shouldn't be the case that there are horrendously long lines for these primaries. There shouldn't be the case that there is a dearth of consistency in how people talk about things. When folks are worried about, I'm already seeing conspiracy theories recirculate, which is concerning, particularly on the accuracy of our voting system. That is extremely dangerous. That's extremely dangerous that we have a system that is ambiguous enough to allow those conspiracy theories to have any sort of light. And it is dangerous because it's going to have people thinking that their vote doesn't matter. And in that particular situation, we're going to be handing this country to Donald Trump yet again. So we need to make sure that the people who are calling for civility are at least consistent in how they do it, because people are getting traumatized and they're going to remember who was silent when they were in need. People are saying that we have a stronger chance this time with Joe Biden, which is implicitly saying that he's a stronger candidate than Hillary Clinton from 2016. I don't believe that. I am worried. So we need people to be honest about the positions that they're taking in this time, because if you're not honest about it and you're playing this for some sort of short-sighted political theater, you are going to alienate the voters you need in the general election. That's not their fault. It's yours. We know that trauma has been weaponized time and time again. It's in CIA manuals, for crap's sake, excuse me. So we need people to actually recognize the harm that they're doing now and what that means for another 4 years of Donald Trump, who has just survived an impeachment hearing and is pardoning a lot of people. So those are some things in particular that I wanted to point out. There's additional things that I could point out regarding Sanders himself and how he might be able to get additional solidarity from a latent area of broad organizing. I don't know if I can appropriately use the words to describe it, but
well,
short version is if
you keep it as clean
Sanders,
as possible.
Huh?
If you can keep it as clean as possible. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, the short version is that Sanders has supported a bill that is called FOSTA. I don't know if I can say what the acronym stands for on the radio, but what I will say is that it ended up decreasing the ability of our government to help trafficking survivors, and it increased the number of femicides in this country drastically, particularly among certain worker communities. Sanders has subsequently on December 17th, supported a bill to study the harms of the previous bill that he helped pass. But he has not taken a stance against the previous policy that he passed. So this is like saying to someone, in terms of a life or death issue, let's study Medicare for all, but let's not implement it. Let's not stand for it because the votes aren't there. We don't have the votes for Medicare for all right now, which is the whole reason why it's a campaign point to get the electoral impetus for that policy to actually be legislatively feasible. So why is it that we have a human rights candidate who is standing for, and who I'm a pledged delegate candidate for, who is standing for human rights as the rationale for supporting single-payer health care, but is not standing to repeal FOSTA, which has cost lives, is costing lives, and is primarily costing female and non-gender-conforming lives? Why isn't he standing for that? And I think that that is something that people should be asking his campaign staff, his campaign volunteers, and his campaign directly. Why don't you support a repeal of FOSTA when you support Medicare for all? They're both equally legislatively attainable in terms of the fact that if you don't campaign for it, it's not going to happen anytime soon, and people are dying. So those are some points that I definitely wanted to bring. I'm sorry that I didn't declare the order in which I was going to bring things up. The only other aspect that I can bring up is there's been a little bit more new information about the county jail plan that's going on, where people are saying, again, that they would like less beds as a code word for a multi-million dollar upgrade of the jail facility. The excuse that I have heard is that this is because it is from a capital account, and so that money can't be used for other services. And I would disagree with that quite strongly, because we make intergovernmental agreements with nonprofit agencies all the time, including the folks that aspire to have a year-round homeless shelter. We can put forth the capital to reduce their operating expenses so that they can obtain year-round operational capacity. The lack of different ideas coming forth around what to do with the sudden political will we have to spend millions of dollars in a way to prevent people from going to jail. I have a friend who was just released from jail, who was jailed because he was homeless and he wanted a bed. So the rationales that come to mind for why people are not supporting any additional innovative alternatives for what we can do to keep people out of the jail, if we are indeed to spend any of this money, is because people are playing a political game, and they have some idea as to a political career track that they would like, and that they are doing favors for each other. This is unacceptable. We know that some of these people are smart enough to have other ideas. Why aren't they there?
I don't know if you know this, Alan. Is the Champaign County Planning Commission, or Planning Commission, would they be having any meeting on this on the jail situation? I mean, I know with the upcoming Illinois primary, you know, just again another March 17th. Is there any way for to find out more about this information in terms of, you know, about the.
So, at least for my headset, you were really quiet when you mentioned the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. I'm a bit confused why they're brought up, because people are running for county board.
I Googled, I think the wrong thing. Yeah, Champaign County Board, not regional. That's my.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no one has been pressing the candidates on this issue rigorously, to where they are able to issue a facile, where our four less beds response. To the best of my knowledge, there is no clear champion here on the county board level. There are folks who are collaborating with Republicans, and there are folks who are saying they want less beds. I think we should expect more from these folks. I think we should be asking them questions. And I definitely disagree with the idea that because money is earmarked, we can't do anything. That's the same excuse that the university gives to all their employees for why there aren't cost of living adjustments. What the university does in that particular case is they proactively earmark their donations so that they then force themselves into a situation where they go, oh, sorry, we can't pay you, or we can't afford your cost of living adjustments, when they could just as easily earmark funds for cost of living adjustments. Now, I'm not suggesting that the county board has the fundraising apparatus of the university at all and has the flexibility to earmark money, but there are rules on earmarking money. There are rules on changing the earmark that are applied to funds. And there's no discussion about this.
I probably need to do more on that and that part. I mean, great. Just remind, but if any other media, I would urge them to get more, get more out of what's going on with the county board. And
And there's every incentive to do so. It's just a matter of whether or not you want to find the hair triggers of certain county board members in asking these questions, which may be found upsetting. People have to be willing to ask upsetting questions. If they don't ask upsetting questions from time to time, then they're just kind of along for the ride. That's not journalism. That's simplicity. But again, it's not like that's an easy thing to do in a job that is dependent on working relationships with people. But we definitely are missing the adversarial side to journalism for our local politicians, because, I mean, depending on the slant, News Gazette might have a field day with this information if they are listening. But it just has to be from a good faith venue. Why is it that the News Gazette is one of the only ones that's hypercritical about Democratic candidates? Why don't we have other venues that are critical about that too? Does D mean immunity? I don't think so. Especially when those same folks make unsubstantiated accusations when they could be asking questions about what happened at different upsetting times. Which is, you know, what we did. When we saw those upsetting events happen regarding nonviolent action, we asked questions to find out what happened. And the fact that some folks have just jumped to accusations leads me to believe that there's something else going on. I would hope that that is not their de facto operation. But if it is, that's unacceptable and it needs to change. And if something else is going on, that's okay. But folks need to at least look at which county board members or county board candidates have been trying to make unfounded accusations against folks, been disproven, said very inappropriate things, and did not apologize for it, got likes from Republicans who subsequently followed those Facebook posts. So, you know, I don't exactly have high hopes for the folks going for county currently. I would love to be proven wrong, and I would love to, you know, see that the people's hearts are in the right place and that they have done the due diligence so that they are actually doing well by our citizens. But I'm not convinced, personally. I don't know of the campaign's opinions on that matter. That's just my own. I don't know of the Sanders campaign's opinions on that matter. These are just my own. But I'm very disheartened by the lack of discussion on alternatives, on why aren't we dragged kicking and screaming into some liability discussion about the jail? Why is it a proactive, we are going to be doing this thing regarding the jail? That's not okay. There's a whole group of people I would recommend connecting with called Build Programs Not Jail that has had really astounding speakers come and recognize the work of their organization. I can't remember the names off the top of my head, but it's airing on WEFT from time to time. So anyway, point simply is that a lot of people will present themselves as good faith actors, and they will believe that themselves, but there is a lack of attention put into certain areas that is disheartening to see. It is just another reason for folks to wonder, are these the right people to lead us? Do they deserve a mandate when this election happens? I would definitely say that collaborating with right-wing organizations is not okay. And I would lump in an over-budgeted incarceral system in that analysis, too. So I don't see too much of an incentive for folks to go a certain way, especially when they are constantly attempting to bully a disabled queer person for things she was not responsible for. That's just the caliber of the folks that are currently running for county office, and I'm sorry to say that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I know, you know, I've gotten the chance to know Stephanie, and I will say it's been, you know, I'm sorry that she had to go this much distress, you know, to run, just to run for office. So it's very, you know, unfortunate, and I mean, I don't know what the, you know, what after, you know, hope, you know, this will be all over after, I guess, well, whether the outcome is after the primary, I hope she can at the very least to.
So there's a very interesting thing that I'm not sure we'll see. So first off, thank you so much, Ben. I appreciate that. I'm sure Stephanie would appreciate that too. The main thing that I'm expecting to see after the primary is the same thing that happened after people had the write-in candidate deadline passed. Most of the county board candidates were completely silent until after the write-in candidate deadline passed. And at that point, they started to make their opinions more known, and they started to try to bully. So what I expect to see after the primary is more of the same. Either Stephanie wins and those folks sit on their hands, or Betsy wins and those folks go on a roast, an unkind roast, where they do not apologize for what's happening, and then they later try to blame folks for their reaction to their response for the reason that Betsy loses the general election. Because let's rehash the numbers real quick. 2016, there was 50,000 more Republicans voting than in 2018. 2016 to 2018, the Democratic Party vote only increased 8,000. That's why Betsy lost by a few thousand. It was a red recession, not a blue wave. We have saturated the blue no matter who centrist turnout when you increase your presidential election turnout to your midterm turnout. But this the Democratic Party Congressional Campaign Commission botched it. Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee analysis is treating this like it is a midterm slump, like normal, and that you're going to see a presidential bump. That's true for the Republicans. They're going to get another 50,000 or so people back on the ballot. That's not true for the Democratic side of the equation. So I want folks to know that in addition to the fact that there was a weird leak twice suggesting that Stephanie would win the primary, which is fascinating. It shows almost all our allies in the state losing. But if Stephanie does indeed lose this primary, there is next to nothing that people can do to change this general turnout. Romney Davis is running a moneyed campaign. He's out fundraised the Betsy campaign. Betsy's campaign said that they wouldn't accept corporate PAC money. They accepted CEO money. How's that not corporate money? What's this sort of vacuous hypocrisy, and why aren't they expecting people to ignore its existence? People have noticed. They told me about it when I wasn't looking. So the thing is that there is this weird political game being played where folks don't really seem to care about beating Rodney Davis. They seem more concerned with the fact that they already put in a ton of money on one person. But money doesn't equal votes. So we'll see what happens.
It will be certainly interesting. Well, Alan, I think we'll probably have to wrap it up. I don't know if there's anything else you want to say to our audience as we finish. Again, we just have one more week, one week from tomorrow, March 17th, and for a lot of students, college students, mm-hmm. that's spring break. So I've been urging them, please, if you are registered to vote at your, here, if this is where you currently live, please vote. You should probably, we can't tell people to obviously vote here on WEFT, but, it would probably be a good idea if you, considered.
Yeah, hypothetically, I think it's the opposite.
Hypothetically, yes.
So, what I can say from canvassing is that there are already a lot of people who have early voted, which is great. We need more people to turn out in the primary. 4 out of 10 people who voted Democrat in the 2018 midterm general voted in the primary. That's less than 10% of our district population. So it is very, very interesting that there are so few votes in this primary election. And I don't know what that will mean for the outcome, but in this congressional district, your vote matters for the Democratic Party more than most places because the Democratic primary turnout is low.
Yeah.
Each one of the congressional districts has about 700,000 people. The win numbers for similarly sized congressional districts in Illinois is three times that of this congressional district. So if you have the option to vote in this congressional district for a person who has gone through experiences indicative of working class rural poverty and will never betray her people, this is one of the few places where you can make the biggest difference. And I've been telling that to folks who said that they would otherwise be voting in Chicago, and they are re-registering here. And that's completely allowed by state law. So that is what we should be doing, telling the people who live here 9 months out of the year why their vote matters here.
Okay. I do have to unfortunately wrap it up. Thank you very much,
sure.
Alan. And if you want to come back on after the primary, or even, I'll see what my schedule is next week, as that'll be the day before primary. I'm hoping to get at least one more candidate. But thank you very much, Alan, for calling.
For folks interested in future events, look up FOIA Friday. We'll be doing that sometime.
All right. Well, thanks very much. All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Alan. I'm going to have to end where we are at right now. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Champaign, Prairie Air, Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. That will be it for where we are at. I'm Ben Theobald. This is, of course, you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And, of course, you can stream us online at weft.org. I'm going to play another track by McCoy Tanner in his honor, since he unfortunately passed away. This is Search for Peace in his album McCoy Tanner Quartet. Thank you very much. Have a good night, and I will be here next week. Have a good night, and stay tuned for more programming at WEFT. Thank you.